Welcome to the Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll explore how dwindling natural resources are forcing people to change the way they treat the environment. First, we'll look at the plight of the world's fishing stocks. More and more boats are chasing fewer and fewer fish, with consequences that will affect a billion people. And while fish will reproduce by themselves if we give them half a chance, we'll examine a space-aged Noah's Ark designed to save other species which are close to extinction. We'll travel to South Dakota with Native American activist Russell Means, who tells us about his communication with nature. These and more stories coming up on the Environment Show. Except for the ones my dad and I caught, I grew up disliking fish. I remember most fish as the stale-smelling and mushy main course served up in school lunches. In those days, peanut butter and jelly sandwich alternatives were not offered, and a lot more fish was wasted than consumed. Things have changed. Not only do I eat commercial fish, but I find it readily available and far more palatable than it used to be. The fish fillet is a welcome substitute for the Big Mac any day. Bill Amaru, a commercial fisherman who works the waters east of Cape Cod, describes the change in our attitude.
Years ago, I remember as a kid growing up in the New England area, people didn't even talk about eating fish. It was sort of something that you kept a secret. If you ate it on Fridays, it was enough. And fish was the poor man's dinner, and today it's become a white tablecloth delicacy.
As our tastes have changed, the condition of the world fisheries have deteriorated. Spawning grounds and water quality are degraded, and more fishermen, with more and more boats and fancy fish-finding technology, are chasing fewer and fewer fish. Making matters worse, increasing global population means demand keeps going up. In 1990, we harvested 28 kilos of fish per person, an all-time high. The number has been going down ever since, and catch has fallen by 5%. Robert Engelman of Population Action International says the future is not very bright.
Fishery after fishery and nation after nation around the world is seeing their existing stocks in crisis. Here in the U.S., the National Marine Fisheries Service reports that over 40% of all stocks that have been assessed are overutilized, and 14 of the most economically valuable species are approaching commercial extinction.
18 years ago, the United States Congress enacted the Magnuson Act to protect U.S. fisheries from foreign fleets, which were stripping the seas almost within sight of our coastline. While it preserved our waters for our own fishermen, Douglas Hopkins, senior attorney at the Environmental Defense Fund, notes that an unanticipated consequence was that a large number of new, highly efficient American boats were put to sea.
Well, when the Magnuson Act was passed in 1977, the authors had one goal in mind as their principal goal, and that was to push the foreign fishing fleet off our coasts. The Magnuson Act has succeeded brilliantly over the 18 years since then, and we now have an Americanized fleet. But the momentum to build up the U.S. fleet was so great that we now have perhaps twice as many boats out there fishing than we need.
The Magnuson Act also established regional councils charged with the responsibility of managing the fisheries in their regions. Appointed by the Secretary of Commerce, the councils have tended to be heavily weighted in favor of the commercial fishermen, and thus reluctant to take the tough measures which many biologists believe are essential to save our fisheries. This problem is recognized by fisherman Bill Amour, who himself is a member of the New England Council.
Fishermen need to be included by all means, but there needs to be input generated in these meetings that we have by those people outside of the industry who can give an objective view. Without the connections, without the constraints of having economic interest generated by our decision-making, I find it very hard myself to be as objective as I'd like to be, because I'm so close to the fishermen that I'm going to affect with my decisions.
Despite these limitations, the New England Council has put about 20% of the Massachusetts-sized Georges Bank fishing area off limits to allow the fish to regenerate. While biologists argue over the impact, this is a major move to protect fish on their breeding grounds. Last week, the Magnuson Act was reauthorized by the U.S. House of Representatives with a huge margin. It was also strengthened through an amendment by Representative Gilchrist, which would ensure that management strategies are governed by science and not the short-term economic interests of the fishermen. 20% of the world's fisheries are on the high seas outside of the 200-mile limit fixed by coastal states. Last summer, through a remarkable effort by Satya Nandam, Fiji's ambassador to the United Nations and chairman of the Law of the Sea Conference, an international fishing treaty was drawn up by delegates of 100 nations. Lisa Speer, an attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, called the agreement historic.
It governs species that occur outside the exclusive economic zones or the coastal waters of individual nations, generally the waters that are beyond 200 miles of land. These are species that include tuna, swordfish, marlin, pollock, and other common species that many people are very familiar with.
Ambassador Nandam, who presided over the treaty negotiations, helped craft a protocol which sets management standards to govern the high seas. He notes that he expects nation states to take it seriously because otherwise there will be no fisheries left. The treaty will go into effect when it is ratified by 40 nations.
I think the states are serious about implementing this agreement because they realize that it is in their interest. They have, in fact, no choice, as I see it, because they either cooperate with each other in establishing measures for long-term sustainable use of fish resources, or else all of them will be deprived of the fish resources because they would have overfished the oceans.
At a time when political strife attracts most of the media attention, diplomats and congressmen have come together in a remarkable show of cooperation to reauthorize the Magnuson Act and to develop an international treaty. But the growing shortage of fish remains, and that won't affect politicians. Rather, the world's poor, who probably would not recognize either a congressman or a diplomat, face the loss of a significant source of protein. Bob Engelman of Population International reminds us that people are part of the equation, too.
About a sixth of the world's population that we consider genuinely dependent on fish. These are people who, when fish becomes much more expensive, and they're in about 50 or 60 developing countries around the world, will simply either have to replace it with less complete plant-based protein, or they'll simply have less protein in their diet overall. These are people who primarily are already somewhat to very malnourished, and fish may be one of the few really good foods they're able to get a hold of. And these are the people who suffer as the price of fish rises as it's doing.
While the numbers tell us that we have passed the turning point and are now running out of fish, these wild creatures have a tremendous capacity to reproduce in large numbers and replenish their stocks. The question, then, is whether we can muster the political will to limit our own numbers as well as our fishing. The Environment Show welcomes your comments. You can write us at P.O. Box 66600, Albany, New York, 12206-6600. Or you can reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. Still ahead, Native American activist Russell Means offers us a portrait of the Yellow Thunder Camp in Black Hills of South Dakota. It was there where Means renewed his connection to nature and his people. Environment Show reporter Bruce Robertson takes a look at the process of freezing semen and eggs of endangered species. Some say the money spent on this would be better spent elsewhere. A representative of the fishing industry locks horns with an environmentalist over the best way to stop killing fish that are caught by mistake. And our Earth calendar will visit the Florida Everglades to see how the hot and heavy mating season is being dampened by this year's excessive rainfall. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. We all have places which are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's a place deep in the wilderness. Russell Means is a Lakota Indian. He's just released Where White Men Fear to Tread, an autobiography of Russell Means. The spiritual center of the Lakotas is the Black Hills of South Dakota. 14 years ago, Means returned to these hills to renew his spirit.
It snowed on that day in April 1981 when I came with my people, the Lakota, to live again in our holy land, the Xesapa, also known as the Black Hills of South Dakota. On that same day, there was also a brief, gentle rain, hours of warm sunshine, and an interlude of stinging, wind-driven sleet. All four seasons in a single day. After digging a pit for our Inipi, or Purification Lodge, we named our settlement in honor of Raymond Yellow Thunder, whose 1972 kidnap, torture, and murder in Gordon, Nebraska had enabled the Lakota to stand up as a people for the first time in this century. Yellow Thunder Camp was a circle of teepees and tents alongside an oversized pond called Victoria Lake near Rapid City. The 5 years I lived there were the happiest and most contented of my life. There, among the birds and the trees, I discovered the unhurried existence that all indigenous people share. As I learned to live in freedom, I came to understand when you are truly free, you are never in a hurry, and never is a long time. It was there I learned to listen. You see, listening to a Lakota is a form of prayer. Before we kept dogs in camp, deer strolled among our teepees unafraid, majestic wild turkeys fluttered in to observe, and raccoons boldly explored our dwellings. Even eagles interrupted their fishing to swoop down and perch in the lower branches of pines and aspens to study us. I was amazed to find that many of our two-legged kin spoke to me. When I sat quietly among the trees, they came to look me over before abruptly departing, then returned to watch again. On their third visit, I usually spoke to them, and they replied. When an Indian says that animals talk to him, he doesn't mean he's Dr. Doolittle. He means that everything in nature communicates. Some make noises, others dance or posture. Still others use colors or smells to announce their presence. After establishing communication, the birds began to show me things in various ways, but always simply, so I could understand. Thus I learned when the wind was about to rise, or the weather was on the verge of change, or someone or something was coming my way. More importantly, they showed me such easily overlooked miracles as how to play and to have fun with my own kind, how to enjoy life. The elderly medicine men who remain from the last Lakota generation to be raised by a people born in freedom were scattered across various Dakota reservations. They possessed some mysterious communication system that allowed them to converge, unannounced, but almost simultaneously on our camp. As they sat under the trees, clearly reveling in just being in the Xesapa, I was mystified by their deep and abiding reverence for a land they have rarely visited. After many months in camp, I left to make a speech at a university. It was then I understood. The soil, the air, and the spirit of this holy land had forever become a part of me. When I had to leave, my whole body cried out to go back. Each time I return, I am instantly at home and at peace. That is what living in the Xesapa means to a Lakota.
Russell Means is a Lakota Indian and Native American activist. He and Martin Wolf have co-authored Where White Men Fear to Tread, an autobiography of Russell Means. While Means shares with us the spiritual quality of his relationship with nature, there are those who see nature differently. Scientists who think of nature in less philosophical terms are creating a Noah's Ark in a space-age laboratory. Lead scientist Dr. Duane Kramer believes he has discovered how to preserve some endangered species. Bruce Robertson has more on the case of the frozen egg.
Scientists say the rate of plant and animal extinction today may rival or even exceed the rate believed to have occurred during the ice ages and times of extreme global disturbance. Noted botanist E.O. Wilson of Harvard University has suggested we may be losing thousands of species each year, species not yet even known or studied by humans. While we know this extinction rate is caused by habitat loss, lack of food, and disease, we know comparatively little about what could reverse this death rate. Dr. Duane Kramer is trying to get ahead of the curve. Associate Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine at Texas A&M, Dr. Kramer says by freezing sperm, eggs, and embryos, he believes he has found a way to save species from oblivion and ensure survival into eternity.
Those animals which die from accident still have gametes left in their reproductive tracts, we collect those post-mortem. If the animal is an animal that's in a zoo or a collection where we can collect the samples from the live animal, we'll do that. In the case of sperm, it's oftentimes involves the use of the electroejaculation after anesthesia of the animal. Some of the animals can be trained to donate semen without anesthesia. And then that semen is frozen and then used in artificial insemination, used in vitro fertilization. That includes fertilization by a sperm injection, micro-injection of individual spermatozoa into eggs, if that becomes necessary.
To speak of reproducing a species this way is premature, to say the least. Dr. Kramer says this is a project expected to last several hundred years, clearly beyond his, your, or anybody's lifetime. But, says Kramer, there is a reason for carrying on this way.
It's because other methods are not adequate to preserve these species. We see ourselves as a safety net, methods of last resort for preserving species. We would very much wish that these species could be preserved by preserving their habitat and allowing them to adapt to their changing environments. But clearly, they're not all able to do that, and so it looks like we're going to have to help them. And this happens to be the technology, the method that I have some expertise in, and I feel compelled to use it in this fashion.
Though it is hard to find fault with his motives, Dr. Kramer does have his critics. Dana West is a spokesperson for the World Wildlife Fund in Washington. She applauds his motives, but questions his methods.
Our concern, World Wildlife Fund's concern, is that when people get off on this high-tech road, which, you know, is very exciting and very sexy, it will divert resources and attention away from the work that's being done in the field to preserve the entire ecosystems. We could possibly end up with a lab full of frozen endangered species, yet have no rainforests or savanna in which to put them. On the other hand, if everything in this world worked perfectly, it sounds like a great idea, but you're essentially playing a role of some higher power when you do this, and there are a lot of philosophical and ethical questions we need to consider.
For example, by freezing, are we inhibiting the process of natural selection and adaptation? And what about interfering with either resistance to disease or creating a new disease-prone species? And says West, there is the question of habitat preservation.
Just because we do have these species, and there are lots of them, we've got to make sure that there's enough land preserved so that they can, they can live the life that they're supposed to live, which I hope would be Dr. Kramer's end. Is just because you make these species doesn't mean that we kind of keep them in the malls. You want to keep them. You want to take them to the savannas and to the mountaintops in the Himalayas. You don't want to keep them in shopping centers.
Or some other equally unnatural habitat. West also suggests this project points to another question, namely, by preserving species this way, are we humans exonerated from our role in creating the adverse conditions leading to extinction, overconsumption of resources, and population expansion into wildlife habitat? West says we are asking for the unsustainable, biodiversity, and a consumptive lifestyle at the same time. Dr. Kramer argues his project should be a part of the whole equation, changing our lifestyles, saving habitat, and saving the individual species.
I would be highly embarrassed to have to say I had some capability of doing this, but I didn't do it because I was reluctant or I was unsure or because there might be a better way for other people to accomplish this.
Kramer says there is similar freezing work being done on plant seeds and buds by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, all in an effort to preserve a dying species and give nature another chance to achieve its own level of sustainability. This is Bruce Robertson.
And now it's time to check our Earth calendar. Many of us associate this time of year with falling leaves and cooler temperatures. In South Florida, the skies clear, the humidity drops, and things dry out. With less water on the ground, fish concentrate in smaller pools, and birds find it easier to get a fish meal. But this year is different. The tropical storm season has deluged the area, and now there is far more water than usual. Norm Brunswick is the assistant manager of the National Audubon Society's sanctuary system. I asked him what effect the water is having on life in the Everglades.
Peter, there's been tons of rain. There's water everywhere. This is a very, you know, this is a very low, you know, wet world to begin with. And the freshwater systems are bulging full. Recently this weekend we had full moon tides higher than usual. And the salt water is pushing in, and the fresh water is wanting to get out, and it has no place to go. And the only solution to this problem is for us to wait a while and just let the water run off.
And what's happening to the critters while all this water has been
accumulating? Well, again, Peter, the critters are evolved. They've been living with these systems for thousands and thousands of years, and they find a high place, a log to crawl out on, or the buttress of a cypress tree, and they do just fine. The people, I think, are suffering a little bit more.
But this does have an impact on the romantic tendencies that the critters may show.
It does, in fact, influence the way that boy wood storks look at girl wood storks, and vice versa.
And how does that?
They see this water, and they don't get romantic.
And why is that?
Well, there's something we don't understand that's inside the brain of a wood stork, Peter, that is triggered by the presence of water or the absence of water. And when there's lots of it, they just don't think about lovemaking.
I don't know if there are any studies that track the relationship between human affection and the water table, but if you are up to your knees in a tropical deluge and your mate finds you less attractive than usual, you may be part wood stork. Thanks for joining us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 304. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartog is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CARHERE. So long. Join us next week for The Environment Show.